Blog Talk Radio.
Hello and welcome to Nonfiction, where in reality we discuss relevant topics of the past and the present. I'm your host, the communicator. Today we'll shine a spotlight on the battling Bogarts, Humphrey Bogart and his third wife, actress Mayo Methot. Our guest is a person who wrote a bio on the life of Miss Methot, Roy Whiting. Welcome, Roy, to Nonfiction.
Hello, Bob. Good to talk to you today.
Oh, you've been on the show before, and every time you come on, it's so chock full of information. So, Roy, let's begin with you giving our audience some background on your book on the life of Mayo Methot.
Terrific. When I wrote the book, there were just so many places to start because there were a lot of incorrect assumptions that had been made, a lot in print. And I just, having lived in Portland, being born there and raised in Oregon, living here my whole life, I was in a position to help to correct some of them. The inaccuracies could have been as simple as misspelled addresses or where Mayo passed away. Different books, different authors would suggest multiple scenarios. And so it was kind of a long path to get here, but I figured, I may not live in Hollywood, but I live where Mayo not only spent much of her time, but she was basically started her theater and then later film career from here. And then, of course, she ended up retiring as well. Perhaps one of the big parts as far as her life is that she is often overshadowed by Lauren Bacall. And Lauren Bacall, for many who don't know, was Bogart's most famous and fourth wife. She co-starred with him in multiple films. And to a large extent, while Bogart and Mayo were married for nearly 7 years, a lot of what we see isn't so much about that later successful marriage, but their Passover, the time frame when Bogart was in Casablanca, The Maltese Falcon, among a lot of other films.
Many people think that Bogart and Mayo Methot met on the set of Marked Woman in 1937, but Roy, you have evidence that they did a film before in 1933. Can you talk about that?
Yes. Yes, in 1933, they were cast in a film that ended up not being, their part wasn't shown at Central Airport. It was a William Wellman film, and they were looking basically for a cute couple. And that film ended up not basically even being widely released. In fact, if you try to find it, it's extremely hard to find. But it also, that particular film also did have a part with John Wayne in it, I understand. And so the long and the short of their getting together, some authors have suggested that they passed acquaintance when they were both on Broadway back in the 30s, which is a reasonable assumption. It's just hard to pin that down. And then fast forward to 1937 with Marked Woman, which they were both in, both Mayo and Humphrey Bogart were in that film along with Betty Davis. And so they married in 1938, and so it's logical to suggest that, well, 37 was a big year because they were basically in this film together. But the 1933 film, Central Airport, is a little-known fact that because it's understandable because that part was cut out. But that gives us basically a half a decade before they got married in 38, to have basically started and then continued a relationship.
Yeah, I never heard of that film. And you said, unfortunately, their parts were left on the cutting room floor. But I'm going to definitely look that film up, Central Airport. So, Roy, I know Mayo had more talents than performing and acting. And I know that she did some singing. Did she ever do any singing in any of her films?
I'm not aware of any outright, you know, songs that she would actually sing on in film. She did introduce a song that's now known as a big jazz standard. It's considered jazz anyway, More Than You Know. And that was composed by Vincent Yalmans. And it was in the theater production of Great Day in 1929. So that was a big, ended up being a big song for her. She's kind of associated with it as introducing it to the world. And it's ended up being sung by a lot of famous vocalists.
Many know Mayo's more popular films like Marked Woman and Corsair. What are some of the others she appeared in that are lesser known, Roy?
One of the most fascinating to me is a short film called Taxi Talks. It also had Spencer Tracy in it. It was one of his earliest, I believe it was his movie debut. Mayo was then around 26 years old at the time, so they were kind of a semi-love interest. But it's a short film, 1930 Warner Brothers, Taxi Talks. The another one, A Nightclub Lady, was a 1932 film. And that one kind of started to give her typecasting, which was unfortunate. By then, in 1932, she's 28 years old. She's alongside Adolph Menjou, and she's basically playing a hardened nightclub singer. And this is kind of a pre-code type time frame. And these parts where she was being cast as kind of a gun moll, kind of a tough person, which we would also later see, in, of course, in Marked Woman, it kind of started to put the thumbprint on her of this particular type of character, either prostitutes or just hard-living woman. And then as we go more into the mid-30s, she's more of a supporting actress. She's not on the stage because, of course, in Broadway, she was a leading lady for several different performances. Kind of all started to change by the early to mid-30s.
You know, we know, as you said, she was typecast as a hard-nosed, gun-mild, tough-talking. How do you think she felt about being typecasted in this manner, Roy?
My understanding is that as an actor, she was focused on a good part, and I think that remained throughout her career, whether she was in the theater or in film. And good parts are seemingly very hard to find. It was also kind of difficult for her because as she transcended from the silent, from theater to some silent, and then on to talkies. You know, she was aging, and the ingenue parts were getting snapped up. There, first of all, there weren't that many of the young, you know, women, the female parts. And so she ended up having to kind of fit somewhere. And certainly she had the acting chops. She had the resume. She had the projection. She had the voice. But as we transcend into the talkies, there was not only was there less opportunity for her given her age, but also because of the minimal number of parts. And it's not probably that much different now. I mean, it seems like most actors, whether they're male or female, are always looking for a dramatic piece that maybe transcends type. For her, though, that she was kind of being boxed into a certain type of actress. And I think that if she would have been able to choose, she would have had a broader range. She certainly showed that in the theater.
She and Bogey were called famously the Battling Bogarts for obvious reasons. But who gave Mayo that nickname, Sluggy? And do you know how she felt about that nickname? Did it bother her or was she okay with it?
You know, Bogart, from all my research, was a great needler. And it didn't matter if it was David Niven or Peter Lorre or you know, Sidney Greenstreet. You know, he was just known as somebody who liked to try to dig deep into people and get a reaction. So I think it was probably par for the course, I'm going to say, with Mayo. She was used to seeing that. And the Sluggy thing, of course, he would wear shirts with the name Sluggy on it. He named his dog Sluggy. He had a boat they called Sluggy. So, you know, it literally was a pet name, you could say that.
but it was also something, as far as the battling Bogarts, something that kind of festered over time. And we can get into that at any point, because a big part of that had to do, in my research, given the agreement that they had in getting married, that she would not continue to perform.
We know Mayo's father was a seaman, and word is that he was pretty protective of her. How was her relationship with her dad?
Everything I've seen shows that he was a loving father. He was a tough guy in that he was a merchant seaman based
right.
out of Portland, Oregon. And he was protective. There is a documented story where when Mayo was an early teenager or preteen, a boy whistled at her, and Jack Netho, Mayo's dad, ended up breaking his jaw. A boy's name
wow.
is John Abdi, and yeah, and so it ended up being a minor fine. He was basically, the judge was sympathetic to the dad, to Jack Metho. And then another newspaper story has him physically being separated from his neighbor when Jack Metho thought that his neighbor was being too heavy-handed with that neighbor's son. And they basically had to get in between them. And, you know, so, you know, it's not a big a leap here to think that this is the background that Mayo was raised
yes.
in,
yes.
standing up for yourself, fisticuffs even. And then she's marrying a world-class needler in Humphrey Bogart, who was, I mean, you do research on the guy. I mean, he was just well known for coming inches away from major battles, and some of those Mayo stepped in for him. There's a famous scene that's written by David Niven. I believe it's in his book The Moon's a Balloon, and he talks about how basically the needling from Bogart got one guy so angry, fists were thrown, and Mayo stepped in, and you've got David Niven and Humphrey Bogart under the table basically saying, we're glad that Mayo's taking care of it.
Wow, man, what a story. You know, and I have to ask you, Roy, was Humphrey Bogart the love of Mayo's life, or do you think it could have been someone else? I know Bogey wasn't her first husband.
Right. I would say that they had an electricity. They were both married, you know, throughout their early courtship.
Right.
Both being actors, they both loved the sea. Humphrey Bogart, of course, was in the Navy in World War I. Mayo's
right.
Dad was a sea captain. They liked to drink. So acting, drinking, the sea, they had a lot that they liked to laugh. I mean, that's one of the things that people who knew them both, and that's a really good way to, if you really want to get dig deep and find out, you know, what's the real story here, and not get a biased opinion, but people who were friends with both of them say that, you know, Bogart loved to laugh, and Mayo made him laugh.
Mm. So why do you think Mayo never reached the stardom of, let's say, a Betty Davis or Olivia de Havilland or others of her generation, Roy?
That is a great question. I think we can answer it a couple different ways. I mean, if you take a look at a world-class actress that's often talked about, Sarah Bernhardt, most people have never heard of her, and there's one reason for that. One reason is because she was a theater actress, and it was basically her
right.
massive body of work was basically before there was film, or at least to a large extent. So the theater being ephemeral, it doesn't have that carrying factor. You can't go back in time to watch those performances. So that's one of them. She basically was big on Broadway. And unless you're in film in a tangible form, it's hard for somebody who's now alive to experience, you know, them at their height, or at least with some of their great performances. I think part of it, too, has to do a bit like we were saying about the timing of when the talkies came into being, basically, you know, by the 30s, certainly, and into the 40s, things were getting more sophisticated with sound quality and production values and stuff like that. So I think that's the other part of it. And then, you know, her age, being born in 1904, you know, she's got a shelf life as far as Hollywood was concerned. And so when now fast forward to Betty Bacall, Lauren Bacall, Humphrey's fourth wife, you know, she is perfectly set up here, especially in To Have and Have Not and these other films that they co-starred in, because she's not only young and beautiful, but she also has a really good teacher with Humphrey Bogart. And they're able, and the online electricity is pretty obvious as well. That certainly doesn't hurt. So it's then the natural thing is for people to compare the two. He was very well known for Casablanca and The Maltese Falcon when he was married to Mayo. But Mayo didn't, other than Mark Woman, wasn't really a feature of his films that he co-starred in or starred in, unlike with Lauren Bacall. Lauren Bacall, of course, with The Have and Have Not and The Big Sleep and some of these other films, she was front and center with him. So not only were they later films, by then Bogart was a big, big star. She's beautiful. She's young. It's kind of a logical thing that people would remember Lauren Bacall more than they would Mayo Metho. But this nearly seven years that they had together, it can't be discounted. If you read Louise Brooks's book, Lulu in Hollywood, she talks about how Mayo set fire to Bogart in a way that few other people could have or did. And part of that has to do with her command of the Broadway stage. She knew what acting was. She was not the student as Lauren Bacall could be considered in the films that Bogart starred with. She was actually, in a way, more of a teacher to him, or at least an equal, given her success on the stage.
Let's talk about the legend, Humphrey Bogart. Why do you think he is just as popular and iconic today as when way back then when he was so popular? Why is he so legendary?
You know, books have been written on this, and I can just touch on a couple. I think one of them is great acting ability and believability. And if you read some of the writings that Bogart, for interviews, he would say, you know, you need to project like you're experiencing what's being shown on the screen. And he had an ability to internalize and then externalize the thoughts that the character was to project. So the other thing is the individualism that he had. He had a sense, his own code, and whether you're looking at Casablanca, you know, or any of the other films that are so iconic, he's a man's man. And he is, to a lot of people, a ladies' man as well, but he's not a Cary Grant. He's strong. He's individualistic. He's a bit of a rebel. And in kind of a similar way that Errol Flynn, you know, was kind of seen as a bit of a rebel. Different actors, different ways of projecting. But his timeless performances, and that's basically, I think, how they could be described, some of these, whether it's playing Captain Queeg in The Caine Mutiny or Casablanca, considered by many to be the greatest film in American history.
Right.
Certainly there's room for debate on that, but starting the whole noir film series, the genre with The Maltese Falcon, which is a John Huston project, he kind of was defining. He was truly, you know, and there are other actors like that, whether it's Katharine Hepburn or Bette Davis, Cary Grant. They put their thumbprint in a way on their roles that you have a very hard time imagining someone else doing it anywhere nearly as well.
Roy, have you read any biographies on Bogart?
Dozens.
Mm.
Dozens.
And which ones stick out to you?
Book by Sperber and Lax is considered kind of to be the main one. I don't have the title in front of me, but it's Humphrey Bogart biography.
Right.
By Sperber and lax. Another one, Humphrey Bogart by Nathaniel Benchley, is quite good. I like Lulu in Hollywood by Louise Brooks because while it's not a Humphrey Bogart book, it's similar to Gloria Stewart's I Just Kept Hoping. Both of those books, Lulu in Hollywood and I Just Kept Hoping, were written by people who knew them both.
Right.
Louise Brooks and Gloria Stewart, both actresses who were very well known, very respected, and they were friends with both both Mayo and Humphrey Bogart. And so if I'm looking for a tiebreaker or I'm looking for an even-handed or a balanced or at least just the most accurate, I tend to veer towards those who don't really have an axe to grind. Certainly they wanted to sell books.
Right.
But, I mean, they had a relationship with both. And so it wasn't like they were in Lauren Bacall's camp or Mayo's camp. I mean, you know, what's the truth? What's the real story here? And that's, I think, like any biographer, that's the key. If you're going to project the reality of the person you're researching, you want it to be as factual as possible.
The story goes that Bogie was born into a family who was well off in New York City. Can you verify that?
Yeah, everything I've seen, all my research shows that his father was a physician. His mother was an artist. She was basically a portrait artist. And they were actually did quite well for much of Humphrey Bogart's being raised into adulthood. His father later hit on the hard times. Depending on who you read, Humphrey Bogart's dad ended up having a problem with pain medication. And the word is that Humphrey Bogart basically helped dig his dad out of some debt after his dad had passed away. There was a fair amount of debt there. But his mother, she ended up coming out to California when Humphrey was really getting into his own and becoming quite famous. And she stayed at the Chateau Marmont, I believe, for some time. And basically they got along well. His mother, depending on who you read, you know, he wasn't a super close relationship with his mother, but it's from my research, Mayo got along quite well with her, even arranging flowers for her funeral. And the converse was true. Mayo's mother got along very well with Humphrey Bogart. And when they came up to Portland, Humphrey would often buy her beer, which was Mayo's mom's favorite beverage.
The story of Humphrey Bogart is, to me, a story of two careers. In the 1930s, he was just another contract Warner Brothers actor, usually playing second fiddle to James Cagney, Eddie Robinson, and George Raft. But soon as 1940 hit, he started getting really noticed. What would you say was his breakthrough films during that era?
Petrified Forest is often pointed as an important film. And it also seems like George Raft would keep turning down these parts.
Yeah, that's
Bogart
what I heard.
Would get them. And you know, if you're going to thank anybody for Bogart's ascendancy, you could look at somebody like John Huston, who basically thought Bogart would be perfect for the Maltese Falcon, and he was right. But that's the other part of this. As Bogart comes into his own, the films that were a good match for him became more and more plentiful. When he was, like you're saying, Bob, when he was a Warner Brothers actor, they would put him in all kinds of films that were just dogs, at least in Humphrey Bogart's mind. And he was notorious for being put on suspension, and Betty Davis dealt with some of this too. He just did not want to be in these bad films. Betty Davis said, you know, if you keep putting me in these bad films, I won't have a reputation to stand on. And so part of it had to do with him getting a few really good parts, and the one that he had with Leslie Howard in Petrified Forest was considered a breakthrough role. But some of the roles were seemingly written for him. And as he became more and more accomplished, I mean, you know, the Caine Mutiny, the movie makers on that film, they wanted Bogart. They knew for several reasons. One, he was the right age to be kind of a grizzled old sea captain. But also,
right,
he had Navy experience. And there were a lot of these types of considerations that they made. And as he progressed throughout his film career, and then of course later he ended up having his own film company, but the roles got better as his recognition got higher.
Oh man, I remember seeing Bogart in Dark Victory in 1939, I believe, and he was sporting this Irish brogue that, you know, was so crazy. And the minute he started opening his mouth and talking, you know, you had to laugh. And that definitely, you know, was so uncharacteristic of Bogart. But, you know, Roy, it said that Mayo Method put her career on the back burner and was very instrumental in Bogie's rise to stardom. What do you say about that?
Yeah, I think all the evidence points to it. I mean, you've got this person, this young person who basically starts acting at around the age of 5 with Mayo. And
right.
She is, you know, he has her parents, but she's an only child. And they pour everything into it to give her every opportunity for her acting. And they recognize him. And, of course, she gets on the Broadway stage. She works away from Portland to New York. And she's got all these skills. And so when they end up getting together and eventually get married, she's able to share a lot of that with Humphrey Bogart. But the other part of it is that she basically, unlike Lauren Bacall, because Humphrey Bogart's first two marriages were to actresses, all four of them were to actresses, but the first two
right.
were marriages that did not last. And so with marriage number three with Mayo, he was very clear. He did not want for her to work. He did not want her to be acting. And so what that ended up doing, unlike with Lauren Bacall, who he basically not only allowed to act, but he acted with her, it caused an awful lot of resentment. And that was her raison d'etre. I mean, that was her whole reason for being, was acting. You take that away from her, and the resentment and the fighting and the drinking are, to a lot of people anyway, somewhat of a byproduct from that. And Bogart famously once said, you know, my wife isn't working right now, and so it's my job to give her her lines. And so basically their life became the drama that she wasn't getting on stage.
You know, Roy, Humphrey Bogart to me seemed to be a very complex individual. In your research of him, can you tell us your personal feelings on who this man was?
Great question. He was a conflict of personalities in a way. You could also say he was a multi-tiered person. He had a lot of notable qualities. He always showed up for work on time, at least to a large extent. There were a few exceptions, of course, but basically he had an incredible work ethic. He took acting seriously. He provided for his family. He was a World War I veteran. He was not in an easy job. He was in a job that had a lot of uncertainty. And it also kind of catered to those who would take shortcuts or would basically kneecap other actors.
Right.
While he was aggressive in his own way, he had his own code of trying to be fair. He had a lot of faults. Like we say, the needling thing got him in trouble quite a bit. But he was a man's man. He lived life as he thought, and he tried to be true to himself. And so, you know, anybody who's been married four times, I think if you look at the Bogart in 1952 or 1953, you know, around the time when he was doing The African Queen, and you compare him to the Humphrey Bogart early on in 1937 with Marked Woman, you're going to have two different people. He didn't have the life experience early on, but as he got older, I think there were a lot of regrets that he had, as we all do as we get older, things that we wish we had done differently. But he, in a way, he had a nice life. He didn't do great at school when he was, was off to school as a young man. But he learned with the school of hard knocks and devoted to those whom he loved. But a lot of times, you know, his own code, I think, got in the way. You know, if he made marital vows, some of those he didn't keep. And again, going back to what the field he was in is acting. You're away a lot. You're kind of dealing with a shifting moral compass to a certain extent because of the milieu that you're in. And I think that, you know, depending on who you ask, the different people, and there were a lot of people who knew him, a lot of people who wrote books about him, you're going to get different responses.
Yeah, Roy, I've seen so many pictures of Bogart playing chess against so many different people, actors, directors, you know, even stagehands. I mean, you know, like I said, he was so well-layered and multi-layered. You know, Roy, I know Mayo never remarried after Bogart and eventually moved back to her hometown of Portland, Oregon. How was she emotionally during this period, and how was she making a living?
Yeah, it was a pretty spotty situation for her. After the divorce in 1945, she basically retreated eventually to Portland. There was a time she was staying in California, but eventually she retreated to where her mom lived in the Eastmoreland district of Portland, which is a beautiful area in southeast Portland. Very, very nice area. But she was, I think, drifting. Going back to her whole reason for being, acting was pretty much what she had hung everything on. And the parts weren't there. There were, throughout my research, she had offers. There was one on Broadway that had been written for her by a movie producer. It ended up not happening. But she also had offers for nightclubs and some other places in the Midwest, I know, that were opportunities that she could have pursued. I think that the whole idea of starting it all again, and by then some reports show her health wasn't so great, depending on what specific time frame you look at. She was licking her wounds. And, the drinking didn't, by all accounts, stop. And living with Humphrey Bogart as long as she did, I think they both kind of, that was kind of their lifestyle. So, as she retreated to Oregon, she ended up, of course, passing away here in 1951. She was, I would say, in a way, kind of a shell of herself. That vibrant person who was stepping onto the theater stage or on the screen that you would see was now more looking inward, and the possibilities having been taken away from her made her a quieter individual.
You know, Roy, personally, I think Bogart carrying on with his 19-year-old co-star basically out in the open to a certain degree. You know, I from what I heard, everybody knew they were having a little tete-a-tete. I'm sure that devastated and hurt Mayo, you know, to no end. And I also feel personally that, you know, Bogart leaving her and divorcing her for the younger woman, I think really, really devastated her.
Absolutely. And you know, the irony here is that in Casablanca, Mayo was sure Bogart was having an affair with Ingrid Bergman, arguably the most beautiful woman in the world at the time.
Right.
And the fact is, by all accounts, he was not. But she was sure of it, and she would show up on the set, you know, trying to see if what was going on. Even Ingrid Bergman said, you know, famously, she said, I kissed him, but I didn't know him. And so, you know, that electricity you see in Casablanca, I mean, it's just amazing. But, you know, they were both very professional actors. And so the irony here is that with Ingrid Bergman, that was not a thing, you know, that the adulterous situation didn't happen there. But it ended up happening later in To Have and Have Not, in a film that, you know, a lot of people realize now that there is the electricity, but I think by then maybe Mayo, maybe her dauber was down. Maybe she was not having not seen it happen with some of these other actresses. Perhaps she was caught unawares. But I think the suspicions, depending on whose book you read, the suspicions were there as soon as she was able to see kind of what was going on.
In closing, I know you dug deep into Mayo's life with the biography and such, and I'm very curious, Roy. If Mayo Methods did not become an actress, what other career do you think she would have had?
Wow, fantastic question. Leaves it wide open. I think she would have excelled at whatever she was at. I think that it probably would have been in the arts, just because the expressiveness that comes with that, it seems like a logical fit. Whether it could have been music, certainly. I think singing might have been one because of her ability there, of course, with her Broadway singing and all of that. And it's sad because we don't have a recording of her. We have all kinds of covers for people who sang the song from Great Day, more than you know. But yeah, wouldn't it be nice to hear her voice singing?
Yes.
But I would have to say probably in the arts.
You've been listening to a new and exciting experience and concept in podcasting called Nonfiction. My guest has been the very articulate and knowledgeable Roy Whiting, who can be followed on Twitter at Mail Method, of course. Thank you so much, Roy, for coming on the show.
It was an honor and a pleasure, Bob. Thanks again.
Once again, I had so much fun. Enjoy the rest of your day, Roy.
You too, Bob. Thanks.
Bye now.